Morning, everyone. I apologize for my voice. I'm still sounding not amazing. So I apologize for sounding like this, but I think I want to do a couple of things before I go into the actual Torah portion, because I want to continue from the conversation that we've been having in general. A lot of the conversation seems to kind of be set in a, without getting into the details of what it is that we're talking about, if you think about it, the conversation that we've been having is basically reconciling all of this stuff that is required in quotes and line it up against the greatest lie ever told. Well, if the greatest lie ever told is that you didn't have to follow Torah, and now we're actually getting into the nitty gritty details all the way down to semen evacuation. Oh my gosh. Semen emission, right? Now we're like, okay, it's almost like, all right, you kind of told us that pork was a problem, and I've gotten over that, but now you're going to tell me how to live my life when it comes time to my wife and I, my husband and I, how to handle a period, how to handle discharge. Hold on, hold up, wait a minute, right? I thought Yeshua died for all that. I'm not bound by any of this stuff. Well, hold on a second. Right? Like, that's ultimately what's happening. And so we're having to reconcile what we know is the truth, but then applying the truth is messing with our minds, because it's so, there's still that remnant as of just a couple of years ago, but this is what he died for, right? So if you think about it, when we're asking questions like, well, what about what's going to happen in the future and all that kind of stuff? Because remember, going back to what I said a couple of Fridays ago, I think the reason why all of this future stuff is getting stirred up is because whatever you believe about atonement is going to set the tone for what you believe for the afterlife. Let's just call it afterlife. Whatever you believe about atonement is going to shape what you believe what's going to happen in the future. Well, we're in Leviticus, which has everything to do with all of the atonement. So it's messing with our theological thoughts on sin, salvation, clean, holy, right standing, righteousness, right? So there's all this stuff, and then applying it like, well, I didn't think I had to, do this, and this to be this, but yet we know that we're following it anyways, right? Does that make sense? So it's like, there's all this that's having to reconcile. I want us to, because we're studying the Old Testament, it can seem to position us, wow, this is a lot. And I'm pretty sure I'd like to just say that, Yeshua died for all that. So because this is a lot of detail. So I want to do something before I get into this, because I want us to not forget the renewed covenant and why we're having to go back to the original intent in the first place to just teach us at all. Because if we think the details in the Old Testament are hard, I want us to remember some of the things that Paul said. And none of us would read what Paul said and be like, yeah, well, Yeshua died for that. So I'm going to read a couple things. I want us to remember that Paul references uncleanness several times. That in and of itself should awaken us that there's something that we need to learn here. Because what on earth is Paul talking about if he references to do away with or put away or get rid of or die to your uncleanness? What does that mean? Does that mean whatever your pastor says it is? Does that mean you get to decide what's dirty and what's not? If we've been able to decide what's clean and unclean based on what we eat, then what the heck does it mean when Paul says you're not supposed to be, you need to get rid of your uncleanness? What on earth is that if you don't know what being unclean means? You guys have to remember, Paul, whether, you know, there's argument, but we've already proven Paul never broke the Torah. He was Torah observant. So I'm pretty sure if he's using words that Leviticus uses, that's what he's talking about. But let's just say that's not what he's talking about. Then what is he talking about? What is he saying when he tells the church over and over and over again, do away with uncleanness? Well, nobody can teach on what Paul was talking about unless you know what's clean and unclean, which we've already learned that that is the priest's position, is to be able to teach the sons of Israel what is clean and what is not. So the first thing, going to some of your guys' comments, well, I had this perspective about trying to be clean. That's a great concept. But how can you try to be clean if you don't even know what clean is? What does that mean? Now, some of us could say, well, I don't know if I need to work on being clean because he died for that, so I already am clean. Okay. Then why does Paul tell you to die? Why does he even tell you to die to sin? I thought he died for your sin. Then why does Paul say you need to die to sin? If he died for you to be clean, then why does Paul urge you to stop being unclean? That doesn't make any, even in the terms of the renewed covenant, Christians should not say he died so I don't have to. It doesn't make sense. He died so I already am. And now, hear me, obviously. Our eternal state and having access, he absolutely made you clean. I'm just trying to bring the reality of earth here. If he really made you clean, then why would Paul be teaching how to be clean? Right? So even the renewed covenant teaches you, you need to do something. The renewed covenant does not say he's so good, so just twiddle your thumbs and walk around aimlessly. Paul is very concerned with the people that he oversees walking in holiness and walking righteous. Why would he have to teach all that if he just died for it all? If he just died to make you holy, then why would Paul have to teach you how to walk in a place? So going to like what Kendra said, the continuity of scripture, Yeshua came and healed. But as we've been talking about, healing is just the beginning. He can heal, which can make you in a cleanliness state, but you have to walk the path in order to receive holiness. And we're going to learn that obviously we are mortals and we are absolutely subject to death no matter what you do. You are doomed. If you're a female, sorry, as Kendra said, once a month, you're out. If that's how we're going to look at it. That doesn't make any sense. It's acknowledging our mortal state that we are attached to death because we are in this place, whether it be earth or pre-afterlife. I don't mean earth in the sense that there's another place. I just mean earth in the sense of he hasn't come back yet. So we are still in a fallen state. Any one of us can't deny that. Right? It's like when I'm trying to chop my hand on the table. This is our current reality. So he points us in a direction with instructions on how to be like him, which is to be like his father. And essentially, it's all practice because of what's to come. Again, pointing to, it's about our journey and it's about our life and it's about how we walk, not so much one and done or what things mean. And remember when I was saying clean and unclean can be in a day. Well, we see that in this Torah portion. in 1 day, you can start off clean, you can have sex, and now you've become unclean, weird, and you're married. Married is sanctified completely and utterly. Like, this is that there's nothing that's not kingdom about marriage. And yet, if I act in worship with my husband, I'm unclean until the next day. Obviously, our minds have been taught some things about being unclean that we haven't understood. And we haven't understood then what it means to be clean. And then we haven't understood what it means to take that cleanliness and to walk in a way in order to walk holy, and why we view it as one and done or an event or because, like I said, because even Paul doesn't preach one and done. So, anyways, I just kind of wanted to preface as we talk about all of this that he's really unwinding a lot of ways that we've seen a lot of this stuff and how we operate in life. So I'm going to read a couple of scriptures because I know it could kind of be alarming, not alarming, but not even shocking, but just kind of like we can get in the weeds of like, man, we're really going through this Old Testament and now we're talking about the sacrificial system and now we're talking about future things and everything's getting put on the table and more lies are getting, it just can seem like a lot. So let's just apply the same mindset with things that would have been normal and see how this plays out. So, Paul, because I think it's fascinating that Paul references uncleanness several times. It's very foundational to his teaching, which I find interesting that we've never been taught then, well, what is unclean? So I'm just going to read a couple of these. So Romans 1, 24. Hold on 1 second. I don't think I copied that one. Hold on. I'm gonna have to go back and see which one I'm actually quoting. There, I can give you guys all the scriptures. So Romans 1:24 and 6:19. I don't think I wrote down Romans 1:24. I'm gonna start with 6:19. Paul saying, "I speak in human terms because of the weakness of your flesh. For just as you yielded your body parts as slaves to uncleanness and lawlessness, leading to more lawlessness, so now yield." So, okay, I mean, there's so much in this. I can teach on all of it. But just as you yielded your body parts as slaves to uncleanness and lawlessness, so they're one and the same, leading to more lawlessness. So if you don't know what's unclean and you keep engaging in it, Paul says, which is equivalent to lawlessness, you're leading to more lawlessness. So now yield your body parts as slaves to righteousness, resulting in holiness. He's giving a direct opposite, he's giving a direct mirror. You can stay unclean and you will continue in lawlessness, or you can become a slave to righteousness, resulting in holiness. Now, he's not saying because you've yielded your body parts as slaves. Let me say this. Learning what I learned now, he's not saying you can never be unclean. He's talking about what you're a slave to. Now, if I've never been taught about marriage relationship, if I've never been taught that, wouldn't I be a slave to being unclean? Tossed to and fro. I mean, I'm going to get into this, but at the whim of what we believe a man or woman's desire should be subject to, and we have it under the guise of we're in covenant, we're married, so it just means anything whatever feels good goes. If we're married, everything goes. That is not true. Your marriage is submitted under Yahweh and still under his timetable and under his ways. We do not have healthy marriages. I'm not saying we as in Kingdom Marriage. I'm saying like as a community, a faith-believing community, we have the highest rate of divorce because we are not taught what is good and pleasing to the Lord because we've just thought as long as you're married, everything can go. Anyways, I don't want to get into my teaching yet, but does that make sense? So he's not saying never be unclean. He's saying don't be a slave to it. Well, we've all become slaves to it because we weren't even taught what was unclean. But he's also saying that the more you learn about the law and don't become lawless, you will be able to yield your body to righteousness resulting in holiness. Okay, let's move on. 2 Corinthians 12, 21. I'm afraid when I come again, my God may humiliate me before you, and I will mourn for many of those who have sinned before and not repented of the impurity, that word is also uncleanness, and sexual immorality and indecency which they committed. Okay, so right there, we're seeing that uncleanness is equivalent to sexual immorality and indecency. Again, it's not about never being unclean. It's about not repenting and shifting your state, right? It's easy to look at it with sexual immorality. Obviously, don't be sexually immoral, right? Because you've decided that your standard on sexual immorality must just be two things, and these are the only two things you've got to watch out for. So, good, check, done. Well, what is indecency? Right? Like, what am I repenting of in that scripture? Paul is going to mourn for many of us who have sinned and not repented. Okay. Now, when I get into a woman's menstrual cycle, this is just like the easiest thing for me to think of. And I talk about sexual relationship. The menstrual cycle itself is not the problem. It's what you're doing with your menstrual cycle is the problem. That's what that's talking about. So it's not about never being unclean. It's about not repenting from impurity or being unclean or doing something with your uncleanness that you shouldn't. It's like what Eric said. It's like in and of itself, being unclean isn't a sin, but doing nothing about it is. And I'm going to get into that. I'm going to get into that when I teach, but I'm trying to do this to wrap our minds around what we're learning is nothing different than what we should have been learning all along. We're not going crazy. We're actually just learning. We're learning what the renewed covenant told us all along. We're just actually doing it. Does that make sense? Galatians 5:19 through 23. Now the deeds of the flesh are clear. Again, the deeds of the flesh. We are mortal. So we do have flesh. Sexual immorality, uncleanness, indecency is in the same line as idolatry, witchcraft, hostility, strife, jealousy, rage, selfish ambition, dissension, factions, envy, drunkenness, carousing, and things like these. I'm warning you, just as I warned you before, that those who do such things will not inherit God's kingdom. But the fruit of the Ruach is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. So, uncleanness is in that list. But you won't inherit God's kingdom. And yet we're not taught what being unclean is because we're never taught about a woman's period or discharge or semen. Right? Anyways, okay. Sorry, you guys. All right, Colossians 3:5. Therefore, put to death what is earthly in you: sexual immorality, uncleanness, lust, evil desire and greed, for that is idolatry. So, yes, while we are learning that uncleanness should not be scary, it is acknowledging death. So, I'm not trying to say these scriptures to point out that uncleanness is idolatry in and of itself. But because we've been so scared of what could be unclean, we push our hand away and say, that's just not, I don't know how to explain that. It's like, that's unclean. So we're going to turn our head instead of looking right at it, acknowledging it, not being scared of it in order to transfer our flesh into holiness, to transfer unclean to clean, to holy. Because if you don't acknowledge what's unclean, you can't change it. At the same time, being unclean does mean you are in a state of death, which is equivalent to sin, lawlessness. But we don't view uncleanliness right, so we are ashamed of it, and so we turn away from it, never learn about it, and then never actually do anything with it, and we just keep falling to we become slaves to flesh. Anyways, I hope this is making sense. 1 Thessalonians 4:7, for God did not call us to be unclean, but to be in holiness. So God didn't call us to be unclean, but to be holy. But we have no idea the definition of how does Paul say in 1 Thessalonians 4:7 that God doesn't call you to something you don't know anything about. But we're all going to be like, but he died for me to be holy. How? If he didn't call you to be unclean, then I would think that you would need to know how to not walk in the calling of uncleanliness, right? Okay, couple more, and then I'll get into the Torah portion. These ones are good. Ephesians 4, 17 through 24, and Ephesians 5, 1 through 4. So the actual title of this section, Ephesians 4, is Put Off the Old, Put On the New. Weird. How many of us have said, oh, that must mean put off? Anyways, we'll just read. So I tell you this, indeed I insist on it in the Lord. Walk no longer as the pagans do, stumbling around in futility of their thinking. They are darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance in them due to the hardness of their heart. Since they are past feeling, they have turned themselves over to indecency for the practice of every kind of immorality with greed for more. And in there is the word with indecency is also uncleanness. However, let me just reread that. So since they are past feeling, they have turned themselves over to indecency for the practice of every kind of immorality, uncleanness with greed for more. However, you did not learn Messiah in this way. If indeed you have heard him, and were taught in him as the truth is in Yeshua. With respect to your former lifestyle, you are to lay aside the old self corrupted by its deceitful desires, be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and put on the new self created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. These scriptures should not just be like a good shot in the arm. How do I actually apply that? How do I know I'm not thinking like a pagan? How do I know I'm not alienated from a life with God? How do I know that I don't have a hardness of heart? How do I know that I'm not feeling? How do I know that I haven't turned myself over to indecency if I don't even know what's decent? How do I know? For the practice of every kind of immorality. How do I know that uncleanliness turns into immorality and greed? And then it's basically saying that the Messiah teaches us how to do it. So again, going back into, if Yeshua died for it all, why is Paul teaching how to put off the old and put on the new? Didn't he die for that? Right? Even in the new covenant, it's not done. We should not have to reconcile, but he died. I'm not saying, but you wouldn't acknowledge that he died. But the issue is what did he live for? What was all of that for? And why is it that it's hard when we get into the teachings behind these scriptures that talk about immorality? How do you know what's immoral? You have no idea what's immoral unless you learn what he says about immorality. So the way I view Paul is he's got these like great one-liners telling you what to do with this amazing stuff. But if you don't know what's behind what he's saying, then you're just quoting a good poem. So, right? Like, Don't be like the pagan who's turned themselves over to indecency. I need to read it in the other version. I'm gonna have to find it because the word is uncleanness for the practice of every kind of immorality. And that and as you read that, it can sound great because you probably just think of what's immoral in your mind, like the top five things that are immoral. But do you really know what's actually immoral and how deep does it go? Let me find that scripture real quick. So the way that it's read more precisely, having ceased to feel, themselves did not give up to, I actually don't know that word, lasciviousness for the working of all uncleanness in greediness. Okay, let me go back to my notes. Sorry, you guys. Okay, so since they are past feeling, they have turned themselves over to indecency for the practice of every kind of, I'm going to type this out, uncleanness in greediness. So the word immorality. So when you're studying this, if you look, so sometimes the word is immoral and sometimes the word is impure. Is the same word as uncleanness, which is in Leviticus. So it's kind of hard to. I mean, you can see that Paul's theme has everything to do with that. But if you're actually doing a word study on uncleanness, it depends on which Bible translation you're using that will actually pull up the scriptures. So if you see the word immoral or you see the word impure, most likely it's the same word that's in Leviticus, which is uncleanness. But he uses, or I should say, different translation use different words. Okay, let's keep going. Walk in the light. So now I'm in Ephesians 5. Therefore, be imitators of God as dearly loved children. Okay, hold on a second. Imitators of who? How are we to be imitators of Yeshua's father if we've been told we don't have to do what his father said? As dearly loved children, and walk in love just as Messiah also loved us and gave himself up for us as an offering and sacrifice to God for a fragrant aroma. But sexual immorality and any impurity, so but sexual immorality and any uncleanness or greed, don't even let these be mentioned among you as is proper for the priests. Obscene, coarse, and stupid talk are also out of place. But instead, let there be thanksgiving. So come on, you guys. He's talking about impurity, which means to unclean. How are you supposed to know what is sexually immoral? Let me say this. If you're married, you could be sexually immoral and be married. Because he's teaching us about marital relationship. He's teaching us about what's clean and unclean. So you can't just say, well, I'm not sexually immoral because I didn't cheat or I didn't look at porn. There's so much to this we've never been taught that we didn't even know what was sexually immoral. But let's, okay, so but sexual immorality and any impurity, anything that's unclean or greed, don't even let these be mentioned. And then it's in the same sense, it's in the same paragraph, obscene, coarse, and stupid talk. Isn't that interesting, though? What did we just learn about skin disease? He cares about what comes out of your mouth just as much as sexual immorality. I don't know how many times a pastor has preached on sexual immorality, but will not talk about stupid talk. Isn't that crazy? Okay. Ephesians 5, 8 through 10. Then moving on, if you are to walk in the light, Ephesians 5, 8 through 10 just makes it all clear. If you're walking in this light, so Ephesians 5 is talking about how, okay, you need to put away uncleanness and you need to walk correctly. You need to walk in the light. And then it says, if you are walking in the light, then that means you're trying to learn what is pleasing to Yahweh. How can we try to learn what's pleasing to Yahweh if we don't know the definition of some of these things that we're learning about now? So again, I don't. think we need this, but I also want to make sure that I'm constantly reminding us that I believe the renewed covenant is harder to follow than what we're doing right now. I know that probably sounds crazy, but I don't believe you were taught the proper gospel to begin with. Because if you were taught that Yeshua died so you can flail around and do whatever the hell you want, that's not the gospel. So, and that is what we were taught, whether we like it or not. I know you weren't actually taught those things, but deception is sneaky. No pastor is going to come in and be like, he's so good, you can do whatever you want. The problem is because you weren't taught what to do and what not to do, you never actually were given the good news. You were never actually given the gospel. You don't even, if you don't know what he died, let me see how to say this. You don't even then know what he died for. You don't know what he empowered you with because you don't even know what's right and wrong or holy or righteous and not, other than your own. And I'm not saying we're stupid. Obviously, our own definitions can help us walk a good life or a righteous life. All I'm saying is he cares more about premarital sex. It's the only thing we do for premarital counseling. We never talk about the woman's period. We never teach a man how to handle a woman when she is dealing with life and death. We never talk about it. We never honor what the female is going through every month. We never talk about what it means to be sexually intimate, that just because you're married, not everything goes. It might get intense because I don't know how many of us were taught that when you get married, especially, well, I guess I don't want to say male or female. Maybe I shouldn't do that. But what I have heard is that especially if the male has a desire, you will perform. Anytime he needs. Maybe you guys have never been taught that. I have heard that from the Christian community. That is not biblical. So, because we've never been taught about this stuff, we have no idea how to do anything Paul just said, because he's saying you need to not even be able to mention sex. You shouldn't even be mentioning sexual immorality. You don't even know the definition of sexual immorality. Like I said, you could be married and be sexually immoral. In fact, it's pretty crazy because there is Leviticus 20 actually says that if you don't handle this right, you could be cut off. So I'm saying this harshly because yes, there is so much good news. And yes, being unclean should not be something that we should shy away from, be shameful, and freak out about. At the same time, I want to make sure that we're understanding that the reason we need to be aware of what's unclean is to change our state. Because he's teaching us how to live as mortals. Now I'm moving into the Torah portion. This Torah portion is not so much about unclean and clean, but it's pointing out death and life. I think Ellen hit the nail on the head. This is all about death and life. And at the end of the day, we are so connected to death, it's ridiculous. But he has no death in him. He is all life. And he's teaching us how to match him. So that's ultimately what's being pointed out. So I don't know if I'm going to go line by line, but I do want to hit on some overarching things that I make sure that I release. And then maybe we can go back and have some discussion on everything that you guys talked about, which was so amazing. This is, some of the stuff has already been hit on, but obviously, as we've said before, we have a father who cares about every detail. Jason's hit the nail on the head when he said that Yahweh is a God who is outside of time. You guys have to understand there are thing, I think Regina asked the question about spitting. The best way for me to explain how I feel about this Torah portion, or the best way for me to be able to teach on it, would be think about prior to modern medicine, what they knew about disease. And he's essentially describing like HIV, that he's basically saying that disease is transmitted through fluid, whether it be spit or emission, discharge. Fluid DNA is transferred. And modern medicine didn't figure that out until, I mean, guys, think about this. I mean, we are in Leviticus. This is crazy. I mean, he is well, I mean, he was basically teaching modern medicine with this. And so in this Torah portion, we are dealing with disease. We're dealing with unclean and clean, but we're dealing with death and life. We're also dealing with, so like we're dealing with like the medicine side of things. Like some of this stuff is just, think about it. If a woman's on her period, they didn't have pads or tampons or cups. So you're walking around and you're sitting on something, you get blood on it. What would you do today? I would assume you'd clean it off. You wouldn't be like, well, that's ridiculous. I can't believe there's all these rules for that. Nobody goes to Walmart and buys tampons and goes, I can't believe there's all these rules for that. It's not a rule, it's a way of life. He's just teaching a way of life. Okay. Now, but then there's also ceremonial. There's also a ceremonial aspect about this, not just medicine. You should wash your hands, but also to be ceremonial clean, because it has everything to do with his dwelling and his tabernacle, which is kind of the two different directions I want to go with this. And this is where it can be, it's easy for us to understand, oh, okay, he's just teaching us about medicine. We just need to wash our hands. Okay, that's, he's a good God. But when I start talking about, but you can't try to approach him in your uncleanness. Now all of a sudden we got a problem because we say, well, he died for that. But I'm not sure why or where in the scriptures it says that he died for you to approach God however and whenever you want. But he didn't die for you to have to follow some laws like gravity or washing your hands, right? Then let's be consistent. If he died for you to approach him in however, whatever state you want, then go all out and say, well, he died for me to be healed, so I don't have to bathe ever. I don't have to wash my hands. I don't have to take medicine. I don't have to do vitamins. I don't have to work out. I don't have to do anything because he died for that. Right? Like you have to be consistent in your thought process. Why one and not the other? The issue is I absolutely believe that he did it all for me, and I will experience a day, I personally believe, outside of death, where we touch immortality and we are fully in whatever you want to call it. New Jerusalem, his kingdom, and we are fully spirit, right? He died for that. But right now, I'm subject to the sun and the moon. Right now, I'm subject to the new earth has not passed away. Right now, I am subject to death. Right now, I am mortal. Right now, I have flesh. So I have to do what he asked me to do in order to fulfill what I'm supposed to do on this earth. I can't just not do those things. That's like saying, go jump off a cliff. I mean, isn't that what Satan tempted him with? And that's what Christians do all the time. Well, if you really believe, you know, get off the cross. Or, you know, if you're really his, get off the cross. If you're really his, jump off the mountain. Fly. And he says no. Because he was still subject to earth and he knew that gravity was still an aspect. So, I don't even know if I'm making sense. Anyways, I just... This Torah, I mean, all the Torah portions, but this Torah portion is specifically talking about being unclean, but it's also talking about ceremonially being unclean, because that has everything to do with getting close to him outside of your state of death, because he has no death in him. It's a good thing, because he's basically saying, look, you want to be close to me? Instead of us looking at it as like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you are not giving me, like, I can't believe you're just not letting me come to you however I, like, whenever and however I want. Like, you're a bad father. Versus, you want to raise the standard in my life in order to match the way you operate instead of the way I operate. Because I would love it to be near you in a state of holiness instead of a state of uncleanliness. Can you imagine having a relationship with someone where you're just always unclean and they just always have to make you clean? That's not really a relationship. But where you can actually intertwine with someone equally because you're equals. Is this, I don't know if this is making sense. It's just, I'm wanting to crush mindsets of I'm gross and he doesn't want me versus no, you're on my earth. So you're subject to the cosmos timeline that I set you in, identify with that, then unidentify with that, match me and learn how to dwell with me because in my cosmos of timeline, I need to teach you what we're going to be doing later. Oh, I don't know. Will you guys kind of, if you're listening, like at least give me a thumbs up and tell me if this is making any sense. It's not that he's trying to keep you away. He's trying to teach you what he requires for you to do things together. And again, this isn't because of the Torah portion. Paul tells us, you will not inherit the kingdom if you keep in your lawlessness, if you keep in your uncleanness. So I have to be aware of what's unclean to become clean so that I can inherit the kingdom. That doesn't make any sense that Yeshua died for me to inherit the kingdom. He absolutely did, but it's not an automatic key. It's not a just, hey, you can stay in your dirt and disease and all this stuff, sexual immorality, greed, stupid talk, and you get to have the kingdom. No, that is a gospel that is not the gospel. I don't know what gospel that is, but it's not the gospel. Okay. Let me see if I can say, Let me put this in perspective while I'm on this topic. I'm going to go to one of the last scriptures in Leviticus and explain why I'm talking this way, because I believe outside of all the discharges, the most important part of this portion is at the very end, because it puts everything in context. And it says in verse 31, so you are to keep B'nai Israel separate from their uncleanness, so they will not die in their uncleanness by defiling my tabernacle that is in their midst. So, let me pull this into the continuity of scripture. Where's the temple now? Me. Where does he dwell? In me. But he's also teaching us he does not dwell with uncleanness. So he wants to separate us from our uncleanness so that we won't die in it by defiling what's his. It doesn't mean you can't be unclean, because we're learning that in the Torah portions. Disease can come, sickness can come, your period can come, right? Those are all a part of the world. Yet what we do with that can be the problem of never being able to dwell with him. He wants us to be separate from it so that we can dwell with him. Okay, so I'm hoping that this is making sense. So that's the purpose of all of this Torah portion. That's kind of the highlight. Like, we have to keep that in perspective so that we don't get into the weeds. Okay, couple things I wanted to note is that if you notice in the beginning of the Torah portion, it says, speak to B'nai Israel and tell them. Prior to this, it said, speak to the priests. So here we have a Torah portion where you don't get a priest to examine you. This is all on you. All of this is private. None of this is made public. So it's all personal, which means he cares about what's public and what's private, which blows everything out of the water of, well, this is what got exposed, and yet have something that's totally private and be unclean while we're judging others, you know, for having a skin disease. And you've got, you know, some, you know, you've got something going on privately, but it's just not exposed, right? Because he is basically giving instructions for that as well. So it's showing that each of us are responsible for our private affairs, for the things that he teaches us that are private. So wanted to make sure we talked about that. The other thing I wanted to point out is Yahweh is very, he's different than any other god. Now, I say that because I'm talking about paganism. Sorry, you guys, I'm sipping on some hot stuff. So we have to remember that in paganism, they used sex in the place of worship. Sex was a huge aspect. So emissions, let me say it that way, ejaculating, fornicating, sex, like literal sex, discharge, that orgies, that concept was used in worship in order to sway the gods one way or the other. It was a huge aspect in ancient culture. Here we have Yahweh absolutely separating your sexual intimacy from anything to do with worship in the temple. I'm not saying that sexual relationship isn't worship. I'm talking about utilizing it in a corporate setting in paganism. I'm hoping that this is making sense. But does that make, like, this is Yahweh basically saying, I want you to be a set apart people. So when you do have sex, I want it to be far from my temple. So I want you to be unclean until the next day. So don't come near my tabernacle. He's not saying it's bad to have sex with your wife. Obviously. He's just saying don't intermix your lusts and your passions with what's going on in my tabernacle. This is where it might get sticky. I might need Dad to help me kind of interpret. I'm hoping that this is making sense. But he is safeguarding even your intimacy to not be used in a way that it shouldn't be used. So he's actually not creating rules and regulations and saying that's dirty, you had sex with your husband and wife, and so you need to stay unclean. All he's saying is ceremonially, I don't want that associated with my temple. not the sex itself within marriage, but what he was safeguarding was people utilizing it out of order. When you do research about paganism, you'll learn that that was a huge aspect of temple worship. And so he was safeguarding that that is not, we are not like the pagans. So I don't know if we need to go much more into that, but I wanted to point that out, that you have to view it from the way that he was seeing other cultures operate and was actually teaching about proper intimacy by giving these instructions. So it's not so much you're dirty, it's just that is not it. Ultimately, what he's saying is even that which is sanctioned will be submitted to my ways, my time, and the worship of him comes first and foremost above your marriage. You, let me say it this way, you desiring to be clean and holy should come above your passion and desires as a husband, even for your wife. You desiring to be clean and holy and worship of Yahweh comes first before your passions and desires as a wife. I want to say it that way. Your marriage, once you get married, does not take precedent that all goes however you two decide because you guys are in covenant and you get to make your own contract and whatever. And the reason why I'm getting passionate about this is I've had people that we've had to marriage counsel literally tell us that as long as pornography is used within the context of our sexual relationship and it's just used between the two of us, that should be sanctified. And that is a no-no. You have decided to define what you think your marriage is, and you are way off base. Your marriage is still subject to his ways, even down to when you have sex. That's what we're learning in this Torah portion. That is a beautiful thing because we are not taught how to operate. His ways are higher than our ways, and his thoughts are higher than our, right? Like there are reasons, and I could get into them if we want, but there are definite reasons why he gives these instructions that you are not to lay with your wife when she's on her period. There's reasons for that. We might say that's ridiculous, but there are several reasons for it, and we've never we aren't taught this. So, I mean, those are the things that we're learning in this Torah portion. So, okay, I do want to go back and talk about something about that scripture that says. So you are to keep separate from your uncleanness, so they will not die in their uncleanness by defiling my tabernacle. If I'm his tabernacle, how does Dad know if he's defiling it or not? You can look at it that way, right? So it's not so much a picture of, well, does that mean that I can't dwell with him for 7 days out of the month? You know, I'm not answering that question, right? Like, because we don't have a literal tabernacle that I need to stay home for and I can't go to, right? Like I'm not answering that question, but what I am saying is what we do with that, can we at least commit to taking a step in the right direction and learning about periods and sexual relationship? Can we learn what you're supposed to do after you have your period? Can we learn what that means to be unclean after we have, you know, emissions? What can we take a step in honoring what he sees instead of what we see so that we don't defile the tabernacle, the person? You know, I mean, that's usually what will happen is we get into something like this and it's like, okay, so then does that mean I can't dwell with him for 7 days? You know, I'm not saying no. I'm not saying that because how do I reconcile? I am the temple and I have a period at the same time. But what I can do is I can say I am carrying death and I know that he is all life And so there is a separation and awareness that I acknowledge that I am bound to this death process. So I have to be dependent on, I have no chance other than to lean on the life giver while I'm in the midst of death. But isn't that the greatest hope and greatest news instead of looking at it as like, so what, I can't dwell with him for 7 days? Well, no, it's looking at the fact that I get to acknowledge the fullness of death every month and recognize how separated of a state I am in by just the pure fact that I was born on the earth after Eve and prior to the afterlife. But because of Yeshua, I get all of it all at once. There's something about just being aware. I want to make sure that I don't know what Jalen taught. I didn't help him. I don't know what his sermon was, but he taught the youth about awareness. And he said something super powerful yesterday when he came and he picked us up because we asked, well, what did you teach on? What was your example? He said the theme of Armory was equipped. He said, but what I was teaching on is you can be equipped all day long, but if you're not aware, you won't know what to do with that equipping. And I was like, oh, dang. He said, here's an example. You can have a medical kit in your car, you're fully equipped, but if you're unaware of the accident or you're unaware of how to use that medical equipment, you are of no use. So it's like, can we just commit to being aware of our state? Like that's how simple this is. I'm not able to answer the fullness of theology of what unclean means pre afterlife era, post Yeshua. Like I don't, I'm not able to fully, I could someone answer that, but I can't fully answer that. But what I do know is Paul says I have to be aware of it. Moses says I have to be aware of it. If it's all over the scriptures, can we at least be aware of it? What does that mean for me? Maybe it's the wrong focus because maybe it's not supposed to be about me. Maybe it's not about what I get, but it's about what I need to be aware of in order to obtain his picture. Does that make sense? It's let me go back into biblical times. The tabernacle wasn't going anywhere. His presence was always accessible. Again, we're always a one and done type people. So what do you mean to tell me I can't dwell with him for 7 days? No, you can't. But guess what? On the eighth day, you can. Does that make sense? We're so, well, what do I get in this moment every single day? Because I need McDonald's and I need it quick and I need it now. And I should be able to have whatever I want, whenever I want, and however I want. And it should be fast and it should be quick and it should be whatever I decide. What if I said, no, you can't be in his presence for 7 days? What if I was to actually say that? What would that do for you? Wouldn't you start to get excited about the eighth day? Wouldn't you begin to really embrace the fullness of death so that when life comes, you actually lived life instead of just taking it for granted? Isn't that what this is all about? Because it's a journey and you know it's every single month. So if there's a tabernacle and it's in my backyard and I could see from afar his presence is never going anywhere because of the community that is constantly living, constantly sacrificing, constantly sweet aroma, constantly, it's not just about me. His presence is not being defiled and it's not going anywhere. I could see it from my window. Can I just walk in there? No. I got blood dripping out of me. That is life. There's life in the blood. There's sacrifices going on, and he does not want me to mix what's going on with my body to go on what's going on in that body. So I got to stay home. His presence didn't go away for me. It's not a punishment that I can't dwell. It's a longing. It's a yearning. It's understanding, wow, I am fully separated right now. I don't want to be in this separated state. Can we deal with death so that I can go and do a mikvah and be able to be completely re-entered I don't even have to bring a sacrifice. He's not even saying it has nothing to do with sin. It's not even a sacrifice. You just walk right in. But just clean yourself. Because I can't have death come where I'm at. Right? Like, why are we so afraid if I was to say something as crazy as, no, once a month, you're not able to dwell with him. I'm not saying that that's what I'm saying, but I'm just saying, for the sake of saying it, what is so afraid? Does that mean he just leaves you for the rest of your life and you're doomed for hell? No, it means you're in a separated state for 7 days. So on the eighth day, you actually understand what being one with him means. It's the same for marriage. You mean to tell me I can't have sex for 7 days? Yes, I'm absolutely telling you that. What's going to happen? Instead of looking at it as a punishment and say, this isn't right, you look at it as, wow, there's something that happens in that state of separation that makes me long for what true unity feels like and looks like, instead of just taking unity for granted and being like, I have access to it whenever I want. I don't know, you guys. I feel like I could go on a whole... If we do not know how to put our passions and our desires down, why is it that then that would permeate the way we view God? I should have access to him whenever I want, however I want, and he owes me. Well, is that how we view marriage? Because we're married, I get you whenever I want, however I want, and you owe me? I can tell you right now, 90% of marriages probably, yes, actually believe that. And that is not biblical. She, he does not owe you. And it is not all the time. So then, but does that make sense what I'm saying? But does that mean he's just gone forever? No, he's right there. I'm married. He's in my house. There's just this one aspect that I'm not able to engage in. Why? Because I'm going through a process of life and death, and that is sacred. Does that make any sense? So it's like our minds have to shift from why is this punishment based versus desire and yearning and understanding and bringing fullness to. Does that make it sense even if I, about the tabernacle? Like, if someone was told you can't be in the camp, we've already seen the restoration process. If someone's told you can't come inside the tent of meeting, he doesn't think that's a big deal. Why do we think it's a big deal? And it's a journey every month. Okay, sorry. I kind of just, while you guys are responding, I kind of just went off on a little side thing because I wanted to just, as I started to get into that, I could feel, well, hold on a second. We're not going to be allowed to say that. And it's like, no, let's just say it. And go from there. Okay. I'm going to kind of wait for you guys to respond to make sure that everything's going okay. And then we'll get into this Torah portion. I mean, not that we haven't gotten into it, but I'll get into the actual teaching aspect of the Torah portion. I'm going to kind of circle around on one other rabbit trail before I move on just really quickly. It says in Romans, in Romans, it says the first scripture I read was slaves to uncleanness and lawlessness, leading to more lawlessness. But we've never been taught the foundation. So if uncleanness is the same as lawlessness and it leads to more lawlessness, then isn't it true that us preaching the new covenant in quotes is actually works-based? Because when it says, now the deeds of your flesh are clear, sexual immorality, impurity, indecency, idolatry, witchcraft, hostility, strife, jealousy, rage, selfish ambition, how many times would you be taught how to not have selfish ambition? How many times were you taught to not have strife? How many times were you taught to get away from witchcraft? But didn't we read in Romans that what leads to that is uncleanness and lawlessness? But we're never taught we were taught we don't need to abide by the law while we're not supposed to be drunk. So then actually, instead of getting at the root, you just tell people don't be drunk. Isn't that works-based? Stop drinking. I'm not worried about your drinking. I'm worried about your sex life. I'm worried about ejaculation. I'm worried about slander. I'm worried about disease. I'm worried about what you eat. Right? Isn't that what, I mean, it, nope, just put on Ruach. Love, joy, peace, patient. Okay, 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 I'll be patient. Okay, 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 I'll be kind. Okay, 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 I'll try to be faithful. I'll stop with selfish ambition. I won't have rage. I'm gonna really try hard not to have rage today. I'm gonna really try hard. Isn't that then works-based? How is it that we're being accused that now we're works-based just because we're defining the root? So instead of you having to even deal with drunkenness, you just never get drunk. You don't have to stop getting drunk. You just never get drunk because you're not trying to escape. And you don't have the mindset that you can get whatever you want, however you want, and whatever you want, and as long as I'm good, right? Because you've gotten rid of that mindset, you don't have strife. Right? I just feel like if you're lawless and it leads to more lawlessness, then how do you tell Christians to stop doing sexual immorality when you haven't taught them what's moral? You just tell them to stop. I don't know if that's making sense, but it just like hit me reading your scripture that it's like we're actually untwisting works-based. Learning these things are not causing more work. It's causing us to know the root. Because either way, you still do have to do the work because Paul tells you to. But we're getting rid of works-based because you're not having to strive and just be in a rat wheel and never get free. You're learning the root of what freedom is. So then, therefore, Colossians, put to death what is earthly in you. If you don't know how to do that and you just claim his name, but you don't know how to apply his name, you're actually doing it in and of yourself and you're in full of religion and you're not using him at all. You're saying that you are, but you're not. Does that make sense? It's like I don't even know how to untwist this. It's like by saying that Yeshua didn't die to give me a free pass is actually acknowledging that he died for it all versus lip service that says he died for it all, but really he died for you to be earthly. So then he didn't actually die for anything because you don't know how to put to death what's earthly in you. I don't know how better to untwist that, but it's like acknowledging the hard things or not saying what religion wants us to say actually allows us to experience the fullness of what his death did instead of just saying it. And actually, it's like what I said a couple Fridays ago, is your belief system actually capping you from the good news? Because you're saying that you think you know the fullness of the good news. So you're saying it, but then you're actually capping yourself from living out the fullness of the good news. I don't know. Okay, I think I'm going to keep going because I'm sure everybody's having to catch up. And I actually was looking at my notes and I think I've actually covered a lot of it by just talking. But what I wanted to do is kind of just go over some main topics, which I've already touched on a lot of them, but just to kind of line them out, the main topics that I feel that this Torah portion is dealing with is life and death. Now, when we're dealing with life and death, though, we need to understand that sin and death are related because death is the result of sin. So this is going to answer, I think, Regina's question. If they didn't sin because they had a disease, why did they have to bring a sacrifice? From what I've learned, it is not because they sinned. It's because it has to do with death. But because death is attached to sin, whether you sinned or not, remember, this is not about you, but about a nation and about the cosmos. I'm saying that because I want us to understand time in the sense of like Adam and Eve. So because you're in that timeline, you are attached to death. So it's not a bad thing to give a sin offering. That's the other thing is our mindset is, well, if I have to give a sin offering, that means I did something wrong. Well, you did something wrong because you were born in a beautiful way. It's like what Kendra was saying. It's like, wow. So the way I was created, now she's talking about a woman who has a period. Yes, but literally male and female. If you are born on this earth, you have life and death. Every time a baby is conceived, you have passed on life and also passed on death because you birthed a human. So it's not just that we have periods, but it's literally our nature that we are mortal or we are humans and we have flesh. And so because of sin, you experience death. Why that person got a disease, we don't know, but they got one. They got a disease because they're not in the New Jerusalem. They're not in what we would call heaven. They're not, we're on earth. They got sick. They got a disease. They have an abnormal discharge. The actual study that talks about the discharge for male had to do with like a gonorrhea. Did they do something wrong? I don't know. But somebody did something wrong in your bloodline somewhere, all the way back to Adam and Eve, right? So it's life and death in the sense that you're carrying death. He's all life, and sin is associated with death in general. We wouldn't have death if there was no sin. Does that make sense? So sin offerings are prescribed. But it's not just about you in the sense that you did something wrong. It can be, but it doesn't have to be. It's because there's disease, which is associated with death, which is associated with sin. So that is why there's a sin sacrifice. What's so beautiful is that there's not even a sin sacrifice with a woman's nidah. It's just a mikvah. Or in a marriage where you, in emission, it's not a disease. It's light, semen emission. It's just you're unclean until nightfall. Clean yourself. Take a bath. He doesn't even prescribe, even though that is absolutely the death process, a nidah, he doesn't even prescribe a sin offering for that. But he does for disease. So anyways, I hope that answers that question, or at least, you know, talk about that. So anytime death is encountered, a sin offering is in place. So we call it a sin offering because we think we've done something wrong. But remember, sin is defined with separation, and it's breaking the law, which breaking the law, whether that person or not, is associated with death. And so anytime you're around death, that's why there's a sacrifice. And I kind of already talked about this, but the way that I'm seeing it is it allows us to fully connect in our fallen state. It's for us to acknowledge and be aware that we are in death and he is all life. And so I need the life giver, and I will never want life if I don't experience death. And that's what we've been talking about, is that our foundation is until you are willing to lose your life, you won't gain it. Meaning if you are not fully aware of your death, you won't receive the fullness of his life. And that is what I mean by awareness or acknowledge. Because that's why I don't want fallen state or death to be scary. You were born. Sorry. Right? It's not a bad thing. But it's not the fullness. So instead of being ashamed and trying to run away from death, let's stare it in its face, grab a hold of it, transform it into life. But we can't do that if we don't want to transform it. If we just want to run away from it and just say we're something else, then we're actually just living to a double life versus getting rid of one, which is what I believe Paul means, get rid of the old and put on the new. You can't get rid of the old if you don't know what the old is, and you can't put on the new if you don't know what the new is. And he's definitely not saying to wear both. Okay. The two sacrifices represent death and life, because one dies and one is burnt, which is the burnt offering has everything to do with him giving us life. So, and remember, the sacrifices are only for disease. So that's why there's the two sacrifices, to acknowledge death and that he's giving us life in the midst of that death. And then I wanted to also point out another thing that is super important. A lot of this scripture has everything to do with contact. Contact, contact, contact. Not just if you have a disease, but if you come in contact with a person with disease, right? There's all this contact. Things, items, washing, people, right? There's all this contact conversation. Not only, like I've already talked about, medically, because of contact was what he was hitting on, but also Paul talks about bad company corrupts good company. So again, even though Yeshua gave us an example of how to make something clean, which we've learned clean is not the end all, he points us to a pattern. He points us on a direction in order to become holy. Paul, post Yeshua, is saying that bad company corrupts good company. What that's talking about is exactly that. Disease is what corrupts, not the other way around. Clean doesn't make disease go away. Disease will make something not disease have disease. That's just a state. That's just explaining the state of things. So I just wanted to talk about that in the continuity of scripture, that again, we're still dealing with unclean and clean and us being aware of our state in order to be able to walk worthy of the call to walk in righteousness, to be holy, to where holiness can become contagious. Okay. Then the next thing that I had was marriage, which we've actually talked a lot about. I just wanted to point out that a couple of things. There is a couple of interpretations when it comes to a time for a woman's nadah. It says that they are unclean for 7 days. One of the interpretations says, I think it's in the last one that we read, says that you count your days after your menstrual state is gone. So there are two different ways to read this, meaning there are two interpretations, that you are unclean during your time of bleeding and 7 days after. Others interpret it, you are unclean for a full 7 days while you are bleeding. I don't want to say what our house believes, because I believe it needs to be personal for everyone, but just to be open, I interpret the scriptures that I am unclean during the time of my bleeding, which is about 7 days. So I don't count like others do after the bleeding and then count 7 days. I am walking in adherence to being in my nadah during the time of my bleeding, which is 7 days. So I just wanted to throw that out there, because there are a couple different ways to interpret that scripture depending on how you read it, which I actually think was the last time I taught on with birth is where that scripture comes in. This one doesn't say that. But I wanted to throw that out there. And what you basically do is there's a lot in this, but essentially what I believe he's getting at is he's safeguarding that 7 days for you to acknowledge that you are not to ignore your state. What I mean by that is bringing honor back to the female, that you don't need to just keep pushing through, keep moving on, do whatever you would normally do and just ignore it and act like it's not there, hide it, don't talk about it. I think that we as women and men need to acknowledge that a woman is carrying the potential for life as well as literally going through death. And that they, because for every menstrual cycle means that you are carrying both life and death, because it means you still have the ability to conceive, but you're also acknowledging you didn't. And both things are going on, and it's like labor. And so anyways, and I and dad can probably speak to this better than me because I'm the one advocating it for it, but he would be the best person to advocate as the father of the house of how we'll view this. But you know, just practically recognizing that that 7 days should be set aside. Per the Torah, you are not to have sexual relations. And then after the 7 days is when you would do a mikvah. And that can look, some people take a bath, it could be in a shower, you know, it doesn't, you know, you're not walking to the temple and going in and immersing yourself. It could be whatever that looks like for you, but here's what I want to press. Acknowledge the shift. Could we be a people that can acknowledge this is going on and there is a difference between being in the state of being unclean and moving into being clean and what that means for you? Because after your mikveh, you have full access. I think it's going to change your life, even if you don't fully understand it. So the least we can do is understand that during the time of your period, we are not having sex. And number two, we are doing mikvahs and cleaning ourselves in order to honor that what's to come is full access. Again, some people would say we're not bound to any of that because he died. But I don't see how this is in opposition to what he did. But me actually acknowledging more of what he did. Because I'm getting rid of, let's just say, sexual immorality, lust, self-control. What did the scripture, what did Paul say Ruach does? Gives you self-control? Well, are we even learning how to have self-control if we just believe we can have sex whenever we want, however we want, and whenever we want? No. So does that make sense? Like, how can we say I'm not bound to that? And basically, so what? So you could have a free pass to do whatever you want? I'm not sure how this is in opposition to him dying for everything. I don't know how me operating in his ways is in direct opposition that he didn't, that he wasn't the perfect example. Because it's teaching me self. I mean, for some of us, it would just teach us self-control, right? But isn't that? But then somebody could say, "Well, isn't that works?" Well, no. Actions precede beliefs. I'm just practicing. Either way, Paul says have self-control. So isn't it works if you just tell somebody to have self-control and don't tell them how? Can you imagine telling a little kid who's throwing a temper tantrum, "You need to have self-control," and you don't give them an outlet? You have to teach them what self-control looks like. You can't just tell somebody to have self-control, right? That's what this is doing. It's teaching you how to have self-control. It's teaching you how to have endurance. It's teaching you how to have the right mindset. I mean, I can go back up to the scripture. It's teaching you how to not be sexually immoral. It's teaching you how to put away impurity. It's teaching you how to greed, greed, lust, evil desire, and greed, because that's idolatry. I mean, you guys. Wait, I can learn how to get rid of idolatry by learning how to abstain from sexual intercourse while I'm dealing with life and death? You mean to tell me that that could teach me those things? Yes. You were just never taught those things. You were just told to do it. Tell me which one is works-based. Now, because I'm teaching you how to do it, that's works-based. Either way, if a kid's throwing a fit, both, okay, you got two fathers. You got two fathers, you got two kids, they're both throwing a fit. One father says, get self-control. The other one says, here's what self-control looks like. Practice. Which one's works-based? I'm trying to figure out why showing the one child what it actually looks like, why that's works-based when both kids were told to have the same outcome. Why is this works-based when you have to have the same outcome either way? All we're doing is teaching what how to get there. I mean, I'm not saying it's not works-based. I mean, you guys know what I mean. I'm not saying it's not work. I'm just saying either way, it was work. If you hear a 5-point sermon on how to be good, You're just going to walk away condemned and just think that you got to be good, but you're aimlessly walking around not knowing what good is. Okay. So, anyways, wanted to get real about that. Okay, now I'm talking a lot about the very middle of the Torah portion, which had to do with marriage relationship. And I've talked a little bit about, periods, but I want to make sure that I'm just kind of outlining the scripture as a whole. I might actually just take a picture of this and send it to you guys. Let me take a picture of this and send it to you so you can see the way the actual Torah is, is written out. So I just want to bring to our attention the way that this Torah portion is written out. Is kind of cool, actually. It starts out with abnormal male discharge. So the first question my kids asked, is this talking about pee and poop? No, this is not talking about, what is the word? What is the word? Were you pee and poop? Elimination. It's not talking about normal elimination. Excrement. Yeah, it's not talking about that. It's talking about abnormal male discharge. It's talking about a pus, yellow. It's talking about something that's not semen and something that's not pee that's coming out of your private area. It's a disease. It also says whether it's coming out or whether it obstructs. That's kind of a weird scripture to interpret. It really shouldn't say obstruct, because if something was obstructing an emission, not emission, but a discharge of something, then it really wouldn't be unclean because it would be inside of you. But what it's talking about is the change of, meaning if you have a discharge and it goes from one color to another and you've got this disease and it's the discharge is changing, it's talking about the changing of your disease, the changing of the actual discharge. Basically, like the skin disease, it's talking about whether it's white or red, it's just saying that if you've got a discharge coming out of your genital area, you've got a disease, and this is unclean. Then it moves into normal male discharge. This is powerful because, like what Eric was talking about, now you've got normal male discharge. And he's talking about that and being unclean until nightfall. So you have abnormal and you have normal. And yet we've associated normal must mean good or clean. That's not necessarily true, but it's normal. Does that make sense? Then it talks about marriage relations. Then it goes to normal female discharge. I should have put there, that would be like blood. So normal male discharge has to do with semen. Normal female discharge is blood. Now, if you notice, there's a little bit more weight to the female, but that's because it's dealing with blood, and blood carries life and death in this situation. And so anytime you're dealing with blood, there's always more of there's more emphasis on that or more to the instructions, I should say. And then it moves on to abnormal female discharge, which is like the issue of blood, where there's a lot of there's blood beyond the nadah. The two outside ones are the disease, and those are the ones that require the sacrifice. All three in the middle do not require a sacrifice, but there is a process of becoming clean. I think that might be actually the most I'm going to do as far as like line by line. Yeah, 7 days mikvah. Wait till the new day. For a male, they're just unclean until the new day. Anyways, okay. Oh my gosh. I thought I had a lot more, but I think I dealt with it when I was just talking. So that is all I have for Leviticus 15. I would love to go back to everyone's comments and discuss, or if you guys have questions about anything that I released, or if we want to discuss, I just love doing that. So let's do it. but I personally thought that everything that you guys talked about and hearing from you guys from the Torah portion was like just super exciting, because there was just certain things like Gabe in the beginning, like hitting on, I can't remember, but Eric and Gabe talking about shame and like the way I can't remember exactly. Oh, I'd have to, let me go back to, gonna have to go all the way back. I want to go back to Gabe's because I remember Gabe being like, what? Oh my gosh, I'm probably not gonna be able to. I want to hit on everyone's, but there's Ellen. Yeah, Ellen was hitting on Death and Life. Oh yeah, Gabe was talking about being a good father and how he tells his kids to wash their hands and to get ready for dinner and change your clothes if you need to. And it's like, in a household, you would think there's nothing of that. Somebody else on the outside, if he was to write those instructions down and then mass produce it, somebody reading it in our time as a Christian would be like, well, he died, so I don't have to abide by your rules and come to the table clean. I can sit in whatever I want. And or wow, that's not a good dad. I can't believe he makes him do all that just to eat. Right? We would never think that way. But it's totally normal. And not only Gabe said he still wants me even when I'm unclean. Not only does he want you, he created you that way. Or I should say he created you in this timeline to where you're subject to that. So of course he's not afraid of it. And of course he wants it. He made it. So not that he made death. I mean, that was never his intent, right? I mean, of course, I mean, that was never, I don't mean that was never his intent, but because it happened, he's made a way knowing that that had happened because he still wants us back in the original intent that he, on why he created us. Anyways, that probably didn't come out eloquent at all. Anyways, hearing from you guys was just awesome. So, about the good news and you guys, seeing the good news, the continuity of the scripture, old mindsets, all of that stuff was just awesome to hear from everybody.
Hey guys, so mom mentioned, me speaking to some things about honoring this process of life and death that a woman carries. And it's hard to encompass in words what that looks like as far as how our family should walk that out or begin to walk that out. And I think at the end of the day, even if we don't understand it or we can't put words to it, as we learn what the Father says about it out of obedience, we should begin to honor that. And more understanding will come later. But I just wanted to kind of give some perspective as far as from a husband's perspective and the father of the house and having a wife and having daughters and cultivating a generational mindset regarding a woman carrying life and death, menstruation, and what that means as far as what mom was talking about in marriage, in the context of intimacy and marriage. And there's a couple things. Obviously, there's a fasting process that takes place when you honor that. excuse me, there's a fasting process that takes place that just compounds or enhances or accelerates the intimacy that you do have, right? So there's this fasting process while that is taking place, and that process of a mikvah and being clean and abstaining from each other. That just accelerates things when you do re-engage in intimacy. But on a deeper level, it makes me think of the inner workings of a temple. So if my wife's body is a temple and there's a process of transformation from death to life, the ability to carry death and life, an altar where there's blood which carries death and life, right? If I think of my wife's body, which even that doesn't really make sense because her body is just the outer covering of the temple, if that makes sense. Like when we think of the literal tabernacle, remember how the inside was very elaborate, very costly, very beautiful, very intricate, right? Whereas the outside was like kind of bland. If you looked at the tabernacle from the outside paled in comparison to the inside. So when we think of the inner workings of a wife or a mother, and we think of their body really isn't even part of the tabernacle, the inside of it. It's a covering of the inner parts of the tabernacle. And when you think about what's in operation on a continual basis, on a monthly basis, what is happening on the inside of a woman, that is something that we should honor because the Father honors it. This like opens up so much, so much understanding and so many things to meditate on about who we are, what a woman is, how that relates to our marriage relationships. But when I sometimes, there are times when I look at my wife and, you know, it makes me think of the reference I made to not looking at my wife makes me think of this, but this whole conversation, when you think of what pornography is, and that as being something that was accepted under the umbrella of marriage sanctity, when you think about what pornography is, it's an evil sex image. So it's an image of intimacy that's evil. Excuse me. And so much of that has to do with the outside of the tabernacle of a person. So it solely has to do with their flesh. And whether it's pornography or not, take pornography out of it. If a man looks at his wife just as her body, just as the fleshly covering of who she is, then you're not really fully engaging in covenant with your wife, who was created in his image, not an evil sex image, not an image of evil intimacy, but an image of true intimacy, which takes into account not only the outside of the tabernacle, but the inside and what's happening on the inside. And so that demands a level of honor. As we've been learning, you cannot just approach the tabernacle or engage with the tabernacle in a nonchalant, complacent, haphazard, disrespectful manner. It demands reverence, right? And the whole point of the tabernacle is what's in operation on the inside. That's what we've been concerning ourselves with as we've walked out the Father's instructions. And so going back to my perspective on my wife and what does her body do? What was she created to do? What is happening on the inside that she's carrying as a tabernacle? And being respectful of that, having reverence for that, and also cultivating an environment in our homes or a way of life in our homes where not only is that acknowledged and honored, but it's something that we fully embrace to the point of being aware of it, making it something that is talked about, something that is known, something that sons and daughters can understand in a better way, so that they then turn as husbands and wives and fathers and mothers and continue to facilitate the honor of what it is that a woman carries, right? Because the culture has said, we're not concerned with it. set it aside, perform anyways. We're just going to concern ourselves in marriage with the outside of the tabernacle and have that fulfill our needs, whatever that looks like, which means you can remain on the outside. You don't ever have to enter in, because all you're concerned with is the quote unquote pleasure that the outside of the tabernacle brings you, without concerning yourself about the operation on the inside whatsoever. And remember, the whole reason the Father is doing this is because he had to make a distinction from what he divorced his people from. Right? So, oh my God, this is unlocking so much, right? It's like Mom said, there's just lies on top of lies that are being uncovered by nature of what we're walking out, and you almost can't help it. You know, if you dive in the Torah, you're going to uncover some more lies. That's just the nature of it. And so anyway, going back to what I was saying, in the house of kingdom heirs, in our individual homes, right, this just elevates the level of honor on each and every woman and daughter, young woman, that is designed to carry life and death and the cycle on a monthly basis. And we need to facilitate, as, you know, mothers and fathers, sons and daughters, we need to generationally cultivate and facilitate a level of understanding and teaching and open communication about this, so that women and really everybody can really understand and grasp what is happening, as a rehearsal or as a matter of reflection of embracing the inner workings of a tabernacle. My wife is a temple. I'm a temple, right? In marriage, not only do I have to concern myself with my temple, I have to make sure that I don't defile or profane her temple, which means I have to concern myself with the inner workings of her temple. I cannot just be satisfied looking at her temple from the outside and having that bring me some type of gratification, right? We have to go beyond that, which this just demolishes all kinds of stuff. Like, even as I'm thinking about it and talking, it's pushing me towards a much greater level of intimacy that is like outside of the realm of just looking at the outside of the tabernacle. I'm not saying it's not beautiful to look at. Obviously, my wife is beautiful. Obviously, she's very attractive to my eyes. Obviously, you know, I get satisfaction from looking upon my wife. But there have been times where I look at her and I think to myself, I married, like, she, if you just went into the spiritual realm and her flesh was removed, she is her. She's her, whether she's in her body or not, right? Theoretically, think about it in the spirit. Each of us, we are who we are outside of our flesh, right? The inner workings of the tabernacle were what they were. Even if you were to peel back the covering and remove the covering, the inside would still be what it was, if that makes sense. And maybe this is beginning to sound weird, but there's been times throughout our marriage where I've been stirred in looking at her and trying to look past her flesh to understand, like, I married her soul. Like, our souls are married. I married who she is outside of her flesh. If in the spirit, all of a sudden, both of us were rid of our flesh and we were just soul and spirit beings, like, we would still know each other. We would know each other just the same we do now. So, like, that's ultimately what I'm married to, is the inner workings of who my wife is. Right? I'm not saying attraction doesn't play a part of it. Obviously it does. We're humans. We have flesh. We have eyes. We, you know, all of those things. But even when you think about intimacy and marriage, like, think about the level of intimacy when Yahweh introduced reunification of his people with him, when he divorced them from what they were engaged in, which had to do with everything Mom talked about, had to do with sexual intimacy, flesh, a twisted version, an idolatrous version of what intimacy was. When he divorced them from that and reunified them with himself, they had to move past what they saw in the previous system, which was a fleshly, outward, shallow, twisted form of intimacy that was evil. And they had actually had to enter into something and go beyond the fleshly veil, so to speak. They had to enter into a tabernacle and understand the inner workings of that tabernacle in order to have true intimacy. So if you think about it, what does that say about our marriages and sexual relationships within marriages? Have we ever, right? I'm saying this, I'm not saying nobody has ever, I'm just questioning, have we ever, it's a good question to ask, or how much so have we been engaged in intimacy in the proper way to where we truly enter into a state of true worship? Because that's what the tabernacle was about. You have to understand the inner workings and engage in the inner workings and follow the protocols of the inner workings properly to establish true worship. So if we're only concerned with the outside of the tabernacle and not with the inner workings of the tabernacle, then we are not, by definition, engaging in true worship. So in sexual relationships, in marriage, inside of a covenant of a marriage, if either spouse only concerns themselves with the gratification or the pleasure that comes with the outside of, if we've only concerned ourselves with the outside of the tabernacle, which means we're only looking at it through our physical eyes, then we truly haven't engaged in actual worship through sexual intimacy with our spouse. And part of that, of understanding the inner workings, is acknowledging the life and the death that's being carried and respecting that and revering that and honoring that in and of our homes, not only between spouses, but openly and honestly in front of our children, right? So that our children understand. And probably the first level of that is husbands understanding. You know, I think I have a level of understanding of from the outside looking in on kind of what a woman goes through or what she experiences. You know, I think I can explain that process with some level of accuracy. Obviously, you know, there could be a lot that I don't understand or don't know. But if I think of, you know, most of the marriages that we've come in contact with over the last 20 years of counseling, most husbands don't care. They don't want to know. They'll say, I don't want to know. I don't need to know about that, especially when it comes to their daughters. I don't want to know. Don't need to know. Well, how much is being hindered in identity if a husband or a father has no desire to understand what's going on with his wife and therefore definitely doesn't want to know or understand what's going on with a daughter? How much is being hindered? And if your voice isn't speaking to that, then whose voice is going to speak to that? So we need to think of it in those terms. If, as fathers, we're not honoring what our daughters are carrying because we're not honoring what our wives are carrying, then other voices will be able to step into that generationally. And I believe that's the cycle that we've always seen, that the Father is giving us wisdom to understand now to change it.
Okay. I know we are kind of going for a while, but I was just thinking about it as Dad was talking, that I don't want to dismiss, while a huge portion of this has to do with, you know, anyways, a huge portion of it has to do with a female. I also want to recognize that on the male side, now I'm not talking about disease, I'm not talking about the abnormal, but I'm talking about the normal, which would be emission of semen. There's two different categories if you read it. There's the emission of semen. Then it says if a man lies with a woman and there is an emission of semen, which means there's the chance that the emission of semen can be outside of a sexual relationship. I think to acknowledge that while a woman once a month carries life and death, I would also suggest that semen in and of itself is also a representation of life and death. Because while a woman in her nadah shows that she has the ability to conceive, but also means that she didn't, is life and death. In semen, the seed is life, but in emission, especially outside of laying with a woman, is death. Right? So there's this aspect of carrying life and death. And so I don't necessarily know exactly what I want to say about it, but I want to make sure that we're addressing all aspects, because there are many men who are not married, right? Or, you know, or even when we're, you know, we're talking about marriage relationship, we're talking about periods. So that would be all women, married or not, right? But then you've got men married, and then you've got men who are not married, and we're talking about the emission of semen. So recognizing that that is also talking about life or death, and acknowledging that state of uncleanness until nightfall. Anyways, I just want to acknowledge that there's life and death in the male, and recognizing that, I mean, there are scriptures that do talk about it in Genesis about wasting seed. But what I wanted to point out, Renna, don't do that. What I wanted to point out is, you know, again, being aware of our state, that when that happens, there's a state of uncleanness. Going back to the scriptures of Paul, what leads uncleanness leads to lawlessness if we don't acknowledge it, and more lawlessness leads to more lawlessness. So there's an aspect where we have to teach young men, married, not married. I guess the road I'm going down would be like masturbation. You know, like it's all a part of the twisted version of intimacy. So even then, equating that to what Dad said, forget marriage, utilizing self-gratification with only concerning the outwardness of something and not understanding that you're dealing with a temple, a soul, and the inner workings of a thing. There's an aspect then that is, you don't have a disease because semen is normal, but it's seed. And so therefore, being unclean until a new day and not acknowledging that you need a mikvah is never addressing. It's almost like the world says, that's so normal, that's just what you do. And you've never addressed life and death, and you've never addressed one state to another. So even just being aware, I'm unclean until nightfall, and I need to take a mikvah, could be the thing that stops the disease of, I call it disease, but let me see if I can figure out what I'm trying to say this. Instead of leaving our young men to just, like what Eric was talking about, wet dreams, you know, masturbation, seeing things, whether seen or unseen, things start to change, things happen, and we don't talk not only to our young girls, we don't talk about periods, but we don't talk to our young men about what the change, what's happening, what is all this. We don't teach, we don't safeguard, we don't lean into, we don't do anything with it. So then they're just left to themselves, and we're just emissions of semen is going on over and over and over again, and we've never stated, we've never addressed our state of uncleanness in order to become clean. And then you become a Christian, get saved, and say, just be clean. Just be holy. Just walk righteous. Get rid of sexual immorality. And you're like, what? How? How do you go from this is totally normal to don't be sexually immoral, don't lust, get rid of desire? How do you do that when you were never taught that if there's ejaculation, that you're unclean? And going back to what I said, if I just be bold, and so you are not in a state to be able to dwell with him. You are in a state of separation. And learning how to clean yourself. Now, again, I'm not trying to say you have to clean yourself, because he is the living water. But he is the living water that affords you the ability to become clean, so that you can be put on a path in order to become holy, so that maybe the next day you're not in a state of uncleanness again. Right? Like we don't talk to our, we don't have brothers that honor sisters during their time of month. We don't have that. I mean, we do, but I just mean like the world, the culture doesn't have that. But at the same time, young men doesn't have a culture that acknowledges what's going on with their body and how to handle it and what it means when you do. In fact, we say, oh, that's normal. I mean, I know that even after we got married, I was literally told by Christian leaders, every man deals with that and you just have to deal with it. And it's none of your business. And I don't mean deal with that in the sense of pornography. I'm talking about masturbation. I'm talking about, I mean, who answers the questions for you? If it's righteous or not, if you're on a business trip and you guys are not together for 2 weeks, and I mean, what do you do with that question? What do you do when, well, I have a desire and my husband's gone for 2 weeks, and so I should masturbate, but as long as I'm thinking about him, I'm fine. Right? I mean, these are questions that I think real people have that we don't talk about. Well, if you, so let's take this Torah portion. If your wife is gone for 2 weeks and you can't handle it, and we're not filled with self-control, and you ejaculate, you're unclean. So there's your answer. It's not sanctified because you thought about your wife. Anyways, I don't know if this is making sense. I just wanted to make sure that I was also bringing around on the male side of things that these instructions are life-changing, because it's at the root of what I believe Paul was talking about when he says, now, because he did all this for you, put away all that. You have the ability to get rid of your old self. You're not following these instructions from a lifestyle of on the outside. You're doing it because he wrote it inside. So now you can be empowered to actually do it. It's not impossible. With him, all things are possible. And so, anyways, just wanting to acknowledge the life and the death in a male, and what that awareness is of our state of addressing, I'm unclean, and there's separation. And what if that is the answer to stopping masturbation? To stopping lustful desires, because we've never known the antidote. We've just said, stop doing it. Or we've actually given a free pass and said, you're fine. That's normal. Because we just don't know and we don't want to talk about it. But now we know. And now we'll talk about it.
What's interesting about this is, because Christianity in general has no answer, in our 20 years of personal observation and experience, Christianity, when we struggled with these things, has no answer except mind your business, don't worry about it, accept it. that's the answer that Christianity has given us throughout our marriage, right? When we were seeking counsel on how to deal with certain things, it was either you don't talk about that, or you just have to deal with it. You just have to accept it, right? Generally speaking. So in our experience, and I would go out on a limb and say that that has been everyone's experience when seeking counsel concerning these things, or even if you weren't seeking counsel and you're just being told about these things, that is the answer that Christianity gives. And what's interesting about that, when you take a step back and you think about it, Christianity has done away with the Father's instructions. And so people are left to themselves to figure out the answer on the inner workings of human beings that are created in His image. But they deny the inner workings, right? They'll say they're a temple, but they deny the inner workings of the temple, which is what we're receiving in the Torah, the understanding of the inside of a thing. But Christianity only deals with the outside of a thing, because they do away with the Father's instructions. So they're left to themselves to try to figure out an answer on how to deal with these things. And they have no answer. Their answer is, we have no answer. And that's because the Father's voice has been pushed to the side and neglected and replaced, or whatever you want to call it. Here we are embracing the Father's instructions, and we find a very clear standard on what's what's happening, what you should do, what you can't do, what you shouldn't do. And when you begin to be obedient to those things, then the understanding will begin to come on what's happening and how to deal with things. Right? It's like if I have a, and the other crazy thing about this is we are the children trying to come up with an answer for something that the Father has always had an answer to, but we don't care to hear His voice on it. That'd be like having a five-year-old running around not wanting my instructions. And not only do they not accept my instructions, but they're going to tell me what their answer is to what I have instructions for. It makes absolutely no sense. It's no wonder why sexual intimacy and marriages are failing. And sexual intimacy is not a representation or a reflection of Him and intimacy with Him. Because Christianity has no answer for it, and they have no answer for it because they have no standard for it either. There's no objective standard of truth regarding sexual intimacy in Christianity. It doesn't exist. That's why there's no answer when problems start to come about, because there's no standard. So it's whatever whoever thinks, whoever is the most spiritual, you know, all-knowing pastor, or the one that's been married the longest, and just because they've survived or they haven't quit just means they somehow have the answer. Well, it's still their subjective answer because they've avoided the Father's truth on it. But now that we have a standard and we're going back to His standard, we weren't looking for answers on sexual intimacy. We weren't looking for answers on masturbation by engaging the Torah, but because we engaged the standard, now we're getting answers.
Well, and I don't want to add like a mocking comment, but we have to dig into this as far as why it's mocking. But the answer is always Jesus, right? So they claim to have the answers. They don't need to look for answers because the answer is Jesus, and Jesus is the standard. But nobody understands that Jesus is a walking instruction manual. So just that would be like saying, here's a good example. I have a broken record player. And I take the instruction manual and I put it on the table and I say, it's all because of this instruction manual. Isn't he good? This is what he came for. Well, you're still staring at a broken record player because you didn't open the instruction manual, but you claimed it. It's like having a form of godliness, but denying its power. It's literally taking the instruction manual and saying the title of the instruction manual. So let's just make this very clear, because I still think our mindsets, based on some questions that have come forth, I can tell that the mindset is that Torah is different than Yeshua, and it's not. Yeshua is a walking instruction manual. So he's like, he's a book. I mean, he right? Like he's the Bible. He's the word. But it would be like taking an instruction manual that has a title, and the title is Jesus, and then saying, in the name of Jesus, he has all the answers. And that's true. So it sounds good, and we stop there, because it is. He is the answer. He's the only way. But then why are we still broken? So it's because we've taken the instruction manual and we've prayed the name of the instruction manual into the broken record player, but didn't ever open the actual instruction manual where he says what to do, because we think it's separate. So because we have absolutely separated that the person of Yeshua is separate, and that he is not a Torah scroll and he's not the Torah, right? I mean, I'm trying to think of one of the questions that had come forth so it makes sense. One of the questions was, so are you saying I can't, oh my gosh, what was it? I can't remember how the question was stated. Are you saying I can't go into the Holy of Holies without following Torah, was the exact question. Well, my answer would be no, because you absolutely cannot get to the Father without Yeshua. Because my answer was replace Torah with Yeshua, because they are the same. But because it's separated, we don't think that when we're reading about Leviticus 15, that is the person of Yeshua. So the person of Yeshua is carrying that on his, that is who he is. We've just said he's the answer, which is partially true. We've just never known what he's carrying to know what the actual answer is. So yes, while we've either been told accept it, or we've been told to pray about it, that's not all wrong. It's just that we're saying to pray about something without understanding even what prayer is, which is, if it's incense, it's a burnt offering, which is full devotion, which is dying, which is opening, which is sacrificing, which is, you know, being a sweet smelling aroma. I can't just put his name on something and not open it and apply it in its fullness. And so anyways, I just wanted to make that distinction, that it's not wrong to say that he's the answer. It's just that what we're reading is him. They're not, it's not separate. Dad took it a step further and he goes, it's like you take a person who's broken and you slap, how did you say it? Like you slap you take the instruction manual and you just pin it to their head and be like, come on, Jesus is the answer. But all they did was like put the, like, he was like making me, I gave the analogy, but he put like a picture to it where literally you take the instruction manual and you just plaster it on something and be like, hello, it's in his name. It's in that instruction manual, but you're not doing anything with it. You're just slapping it on something or putting his name on something or putting that book on something. But anyways, it was just funny because he was like, yeah, we just tell people like in the name of Jesus. And we just take the instruction manual and like pin it to their forehead, not realizing what it is that we're even saying when we say that, which goes back to Jalen's teaching of being equipped, but you're unaware of how to use the equipping, so you're still stuck in a state.
I don't know if I'm understanding your question about public and private, but I can re-explain. Meaning, I don't know if I understand, does the public aspect refer to me bringing a sacrifice to the public temple or the needing to go outside the camp? Are you just saying because those are public that that's public? Because obviously those things are not in relationship to your period because you don't ever have to bring a sacrifice because of your period and you're never told to go outside the camp because of your period. So are you just asking, is a sacrifice public? The answer is yes. Is going outside the camp public? The answer is yes. But does that have anything to do with this Torah portion? No. So what I'm saying about private is the sense that no, you will not have a priest telling you when your period is starting or ending. That's up to you. Just like you don't have a priest saying, well, you ejaculated today, so you're unclean until nightfall, because all of those things are private in the sense that it's your responsibility to know what's clean and unclean, because a priest wouldn't know those things because they're not, it's not their responsibility. The reason why the skin disease is their responsibility is because something that, if you think about, was private, let's say slander, a priest is not there to evaluate your every move. And so then if it manifests in sickness, then they have to get involved because now it is public. But a priest, granted, I mean, it's public in the sense that if you're unclean and you're bleeding everywhere and you touch something, you can make something else unclean. So it can become public, but there isn't a priest that's going to tell you when, where, how, and what. It's our own responsibility to know how to manage those things. So that's what I meant by private, in the sense that the instructions are given to the children, not to the priests, who have to make that evaluation, because you're the only one that can make that evaluation in these in this Torah portion. But let me know if that's answering your question. But yes, you're right. A priest does not need to come tell you when to do a mikvah in regards to your period. But yes, sacrifices are public, as well as going outside the camp. But that wouldn't have anything. The only thing that would be made public in that regard would be as if you had a disease. Let me know if that makes sense.